All right, the final matter on our oral calendar this morning is the welfare of the children of JBO et al. There are three consolidated files. I understand that there will only be one argument for any of the appellants. Is that right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. I'm the only one who requested an oral argument.
All right. And each of you will have 15 minutes, of course, for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent, just so that we've got that for the recording. You can adjust the podium up or down to suit your comfort. Whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Merchant, and I represent the appellant J.O., a 15-year-old high school honors student who, in no uncertain terms, told the juvenile court, the department's child protection social worker, and his guardian ad litem that he did not want his father's parental rights terminated. And he testified at trial that if they were, he would suffer emotional harm. Testimony the department did not cross-examine or that was otherwise rebutted. This court should reverse the termination order with respect to J.O. because the juvenile court's termination erred as a matter of law in its best interest determination when it gave J.O.'s preference only neutral weight rather than the significant weight that the law requires.
J.O. is 15 now?
That's correct, Judge
Larkin.
When
does he turn 16?
I believe it's in March.
In March, so 15 and a half.
Correct.
Do you know, is there a no contact order prohibiting father from having contact with J.O.? As a result
I don't know for certain, Judge Larkin, but I do know that in the record it's reflected that he continues to maintain phone contact with his father.
By phone?
That's correct.
Do you know if, or is there, I shouldn't ask if you know, I should ask if the record contains anything about the impact, if any, on a minor child visiting in person at prison persons who are not that child's parent.
Who is?
Or whose rights have been terminated. Here's the specific question I'm asking. He has phone conversation with him. Can he, after the termination of his father's parental rights, have in-person visits at all? Or is that, I can imagine that the prison might take a dim view of minors mm-hmm. having in-person visits with anybody in their facility, unless it's their parent.
My view, Judge Rodenberg, is there's no definitive evidence in the record on that. The only evidence at all is in the guardian ad litem's statement where she says that based on some past experience, she understands that all minors, irrespective of whether they're the children of the resident at the department at the prison, can have contact with someone who's been convicted of a sex offense. That's the only evidence in the record at all.
Okay, thank you.
Is your client in therapy or had your client been in therapy?
He has been in therapy.
And did the therapist render an opinion regarding the harm or benefit of continued contact with father?
She did not, Judge Larkin. In fact, the department didn't put on any evidence on that issue at all. The only evidence with respect to the therapist is found, I think it's on page 54 of the father's addendum, where there's a reference by the child protection social worker in her pre-hearing report to what the therapist had said about J.O., and he was participating both in individual therapy with the therapist as well as family therapy. And while there were the department references that some of that in the department's brief that he had displayed a flat effect and didn't show joy or happiness, but if you read the entire rendition in the pre-hearing report, I think it's fair to say that the that on balance, the therapist thought that he was doing pretty well. He was participating. She said that there were still challenges, but he had was having to figure out how to negotiate what had happened. And if you look, I think it's the preceding page on 53 of Father's addendum, the child protection social worker actually characterizes my client as doing good based on her interpretation of what she understood the therapist to say. So I think it's important to bring this out at the very beginning of my argument, because I'd like the court to consider this and its overall analysis. And that is, we all know that in termination proceedings, the paramount consideration is the child's best interest. And this ruling does not help J.O. It's harming him. He wants a relationship with his father. And he testified at trial, again unrebutted, that he values this relationship and what it would mean to him if it were ended.
Mr. Merchant, can I ask you, I'm looking at the court's findings, and I believe your child was child two, is that correct? Am I reading that correctly?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And finding 30.6, the last sentence, the court believes that based upon the children's needs, history and vulnerability, that it is in the children's best interest to be cared only by a safe provider, and then says Mr. Oluwalo is not safe or appropriate. Two questions. Do you read that finding, therefore, to be a conclusion, a finding related to both child one and child two, and do you think that's a important distinction that was missed by the court as to your client versus the older child? And then secondly, wasn't clear, but I'm assuming they're being cared by their mother in a safe environment otherwise, and Mr. Oluwalo is in prison.
That's correct, Judge Slater. And so I agree with your first question. I think it was an error by the juvenile court to lump the two together, and I've argued that quite a bit in my briefs. It has to be an individual analysis. And second, I point this out in my reply brief in the second section, and you can look to the specific references in the record that I cite there for this, the support of this point. But the point is that the court's finding that it was not safe with respect to my client, J.O., is clearly erroneous. There's nothing in the record that shows that my client's father posed a safety threat to his son, my client. In fact, the child protection social worker testified at trial on page 20 of the trial transcript that she did not have any concerns at all about Mr. Oluwalo's criminal offense as it applied to J.O. And if you look at what happened in this case, from the very outset, the department never had any compunction whatsoever about allowing my client to continue to have a relationship with his father. He was permitted, without objection from the department, to have phone visits with his father immediately, beginning at the emergency protective hearing on November 1st. On November 20th, when they came back for the admit-deny hearing, he was able to begin having supervised visits with his father. And in January, 2 months after the case began, the department did not oppose him having unsupervised visits with his father. So this notion that Mr. Oluwalo posed a safety threat to my client is just not borne out in the record, and it's a clearly erroneous finding by the juvenile court. And maybe I didn't fully answer your second question, yes. He is being cared by his mother. All of the other competing interests in the balancing analysis that's employed for purposes of evaluating the best interests of a child, as I've argued in my briefs, militate in favor of my client. He's safe, he's in a stable environment, his health is fine. All of his material needs are being met by his mother.
Can you tell me, how old is EO now?
I think she's going on 18. She's nearing 18.
Does the record show that she's still in the home at the time of the termination trial?
She was.
Does the record show there were any conflicts between she and J.O. regarding the abuse she suffered?
No, and in fact, this case, again, started on November 1st, the emergency protective hearing. The first thing that J.O. said, if you look at the transcript from that hearing, and then again on the 20th, a few days before Thanksgiving, he wanted to somehow have the court arrange so that he could have Thanksgiving with both his father and recognizing the court's instruction that his father couldn't have any contact with his sister, and have Thanksgiving with his sister and his mother. That's always been a driving concern of his, is to continue to have a meaningful relationship with his sister, and there's virtually nothing in the record that shows that there's been any negative impact in terms of their relationship.
Is there any evidence in the record that suggests that J.O. is not willing to acknowledge or accept the abuse that his sister suffered, that he's not dealing with the reality of the situation?
Absolutely not. Again, the only thing, and I talk about this both in my brief and my reply brief, was the GAL, the guardian's statement at trial that she had some concerns about whether or not J.O. understood the entire consequences of what had happened. And as I argue in my briefs, he testified at trial that he knew what had happened. He was talking with his therapist about this. I believe it's, I can give the court the site if it wants. In the preliminary hearing report, the child protection worker makes an entry that she spoke with J.O. about the termination proceeding, and he said, yes, I've read the petition, and I understand the consequences it has for our family. So, again, the only thing at all is the guardian's expressed very abbreviated, unsupported concern, other than perhaps her interaction with him. And that just is not clear and convincing evidence that outweighs all of the other competing interests that weigh in favor of J.O., not the least of which, of course, is the fact that he wants to have a relationship with his father.
What has the county's involvement with the family been since the termination? In other words, is the county still watching over his therapy, providing services, that sort of thing?
Judge Larkin, I can't really speak to that other than I know that there's been at least one other hearing, but I don't represent him in the juvenile
court. In the district
court
proceeding. Okay.
Right, and so I don't know what, I just can't speak to that.
Mr. Merchant, in the remaining time, of which there isn't so terribly much, so I'll try to get right to this. I want to talk just a little bit about the 260.012 issue. You argue, and I think the record supports this argument, that the district court never relieved the county of the obligation, never actually relieved the county of the obligation of providing reasonable efforts. And I think that's much as clear.
I don't think that's disputed.
It isn't, I don't think. The county argues that you waived or forfeited that by not having raised it. Here's my question. Do you agree that the evidence at trial was sufficient to support a finding that a child was subjected to egregious harm by the father? That was one of the findings the district court made after trial, and I don't think you've challenged that.
I don't think that that's the statutory ground under 1B6 was challenged, Judge Rodenberg, and I'm not in a position to contest that here.
That language seems almost identical to one of the subparts of 260.012A and one of the circumstances which allow the district court to grant the county a bypass, for I'll just use that word, on reasonable efforts. That is, if the child, if there's a prima facie case that the child was subjected to egregious harm, the district court can relieve the county of that reunification obligation. You agree with all of that?
Not entirely, Judge Rodenberg. And I call your attention to your opinion in DET.
That's where I'm trying to get to.
Okay. What I don't entirely agree with, which is, I don't disagree that the language is similar, but that finding wasn't made at the emergency protective care hearing. All that the only finding was that a juvenile protection matter existed, and then the finding that for purposes of EO, it warranted removal from the home and protective supervision, which of course is the only purpose of the emergency protective hearing.
To determine whether the child's gonna stay in care or be returned.
Exactly, right. And under those seven bypass provisions, the preface to that is very precise, which you talk about in DET, and it, of course, supported in other case law, that there has to be a specific finding of one of those statutory grounds. And I know that the department has argued in its brief that the court's finding for purposes of a juvenile protection matter subsumes within it the finding of a specific statutory ground, but it doesn't.
That was only my windup. Here's my pitch, and I don't know. I don't know if there's a case that has determined this precise question. If the district court would have made a finding of a prima facie case of egregious harm, is it then required to relieve the county of the obligation to use reasonable efforts to reunify? Or is it just permitted to relieve the county of that obligation?
I'd have to study that some more, Judge Rodenberg.
Why don't you think about that, and we can talk about it on rebuttal, because I have the same question for the county.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I am appearing on behalf of the respondent, Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. To begin by addressing Judge Rodenberg's most recent question, I would direct the court to, the rules have been renumbered, so it's the new rule 42 of the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure. Rule 42 regards the emergency protective care hearing. Specifically, the end of Rule 42.08 states that it talks about making findings regarding reasonable efforts and ends, in the alternative, the court shall determine that reasonable efforts are not required if the court makes a prima facie determination that one of the circumstances under Subdivision 1D exists.
So in your view, if there is a prima facie showing of egregious harm in the petition and attachments, then the district court must relieve the county of the obligation of reunifying?
Correct, Your Honor. That is my interpretation of Rule 42, but more importantly, my interpretation of Minnesota Statute 260.012, paragraph A. That statute itself is very clear that once there is that prima facie finding of egregious harm, the department is relieved of reasonable efforts. There's nothing that requires the district court to make any auxiliary findings beyond that prima facie finding of egregious harm.
I have to say that's not the way I read that last sentence of 260.012A. It says reasonable efforts to prevent placement and for rehabilitation and reunification are always required, except upon a determination by the court that a petition has been filed stating a prima facie case. suggesting that there's some significance to the court making the determination and that that would be sufficient to support a bypass.
The court has to make the determination that the petition makes a prima facie showing of egregious harm. Once the court makes that decision, the statute is triggered and reasonable efforts are no longer required. The statute does not require the court to then make a second finding about regarding reasonable efforts that are specific to reasonable efforts. The statute just requires if the judge finds that the petition can move forward on egregious harm, then as an operation of the statute, the department is not required to make reasonable efforts.
With that reading, Ms. Nicholson, how would a respondent, at what point is there not an opportunity? So, for instance, one of the subdivisions has to do with abandonment, which almost always is a factual, the petitioner may allege factually abandonment, hence a bypass, but could there not be a factual dispute as to that, hence there's an opportunity? Could not, number one, the court defer making that decision to allow presentation of evidence regarding that, to give some opportunity before completing the termination trial, in other words?
So the rules do allow for a continuance if a respondent does want to contest the prima facie showing on the four corners of the petition. That didn't happen in this case. At the very first hearing, the court looked at the petition, made the prima facie showing of egregious harm, and if you look at the initial order from the
District Court didn't make that finding, did it?
No. Regarding egregious harm?
Correct.
It found a prima facie basis for a termination of parental rights on the four corners of the document, which is all based on egregious harm. And if you look at the written order from that hearing, the boxes are checked for that a child suffered physical or sexual abuse. So the court did make that finding based on the petition. And in order to allow that termination petition...
clarify, so you don't read the statutory obligation, a determination by the court, to be a separate finding and conclusion by a court versus simply setting the matter for trial based on the petition?
It's my understanding that in this case, at that first hearing on November 1st, 2017, that the court found that on the four corners of the document there was a prima facie case for a juvenile protection matter on both petitions. The court specifically mentioned both petitions, which includes the termination petition, and that he would allow those petitions to move forward.
But isn't that a separate, though? That's required in all child protection, a judge make that finding, but you're saying that implicitly also is a finding of egregious harm, thus a bypass if the court finds prima facie basis of a child protection proceeding based on this petition, and if the petition has facts which support egregious harm, that's equivalent of satisfying the statute and the rule that...
In this particular case, it was, because the entire petition was based on egregious harm and sexual abuse of EO. There were no other facts that justified a child protection matter. The only facts that justified it were the sexual abuse of this child. And I reiterate again, the court did check the box finding that a child had been physically or sexually abused in the order from that first hearing. So because the judge made those findings and allowed the petition to move forward, and the petition was only 100% based on the sexual abuse of a child, which falls squarely within the definition of egregious harm, that was sufficient to statutorily relieve the Department of Reasonable Efforts. And the court reiterated that finding at a hearing, I believe it was in August of 2018, in the face of multiple motions to dismiss, reiterated, I already made findings that these petitions may move forward and there's enough evidence in these petitions for trial. And again, the only facts alleged in these petitions are regarding the sexual abuse of EO. So based on the contents of the petition and the judge's findings on those contents, there was a finding, a prima facie finding, to allow the petitions to move forward on egregious harm.
It seems like the district court, this is a very unique and tragic case, but it seems like if the district court would have, again, at least raised that question, some of the arguments that are now being made about best interests might better have been addressed at that point in time had the county said, as it said it was going to, come back and ask for the bypass. And then the parties could have aired that all out and these exceptional children could have been heard early on.
Well, I believe the children did have the opportunity to be heard throughout the case. And as the judge noted at one of the hearings, the desires of the children do not necessarily equate to the best interests of the children. So the children did have attorneys. They were present. One was granted party status. They did have the opportunity to be heard throughout the case. But the prima facie threshold was just whether or not there was a prima facie showing of egregious harm. And I would reiterate, as I pointed out in my brief, nobody contested egregious harm, either at the initial hearing, at trial, or even now on appeal. The parties all agree that egregious harm occurred. The parties throughout the entire case operated in the framework of an egregious harm case. Nobody ever challenged reasonable efforts.
Counsel, could we move to what is challenged, and that is the best interests of the children? Could you tell me the county's position as to why it is in the best interests of EO and JO to terminate father's parental rights?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Specifically, the district court made findings on pages 10 and 11 of its TPR order regarding the children's best interests. There is concern about the past physical harm he inflicted on EO, which also then has given her lifelong trauma that she will have to cope with the rest of her life. And there is a future.
How does terminating his parental rights address that concern?
Your Honor, the termination of parental rights frees EO of the legal control that the father has over her.
Okay, but EO is going to be an adult long before he's released from prison.
If his anticipated release date remains the same, then she would become an adult before he was released.
Well, I mean, she's going to become an adult in a matter of months, right?
I'm not sure of her exact birth date off the top of my head, but I do know
she's 17
still,
plus.
She's over 17
okay.
at this point.
So I'm having a hard time understanding why termination is necessary to eliminate the control he would have over her if she's going to breach the age of majority soon.
Well, at the time of the trial, there was still over a year of her being a minor. And for J.O., there was over 3 years, or slightly about 3 years, of him still being a minor. And he is, not only would he have parental rights, but he's a joint legal custodian of the children, which gives him a large amount of control over decisions regarding the children, their future, and decisions that could affect their safety and well-being. And in this case, he has shown through his abhorrent conduct towards his daughter that he does not prioritize his children. He focuses on his own wants, desires, impulses. He utilized grooming, fear, escalation over a period of 7 years. These are not the characteristics of somebody that is a safe and suitable parent who should be making decisions about his children's welfare. He has forfeited that right by abusing his child in such a drastic and traumatizing manner that will affect her for the rest of her life. His decision-making capacity is not safe or healthy for these children. And the district court pointed that out by saying the risk of legal contact with these children for the duration of their minority is sufficient to warrant a termination of parental rights.
And if his rights are terminated, does that prevent him from contacting the children?
A termination of parental rights is not a no-contact order, Your Honor. It just means that he does not have legal decision-making control over these children's futures. And he has
no
legally...
Is the mother asking that his rights be terminated so she will be the sole legal and physical custodian of the children?
No, Your Honor. The mother was opposed to the termination of parental rights.
I'm just trying to be realistic and ask, what does termination accomplish here? I understand it makes a point, a societal point, that this is abhorrent behavior and you shouldn't be allowed to have children. I completely agree. But we have children who have expressed a different view, and we have no indication that the children are failing in their health or well-being. And it seems, for all intents and purposes, there's going to be continued contact here. So what does the termination really accomplish here? Is it simply to make the societal point that someone who does this should not be allowed to have rights to children?
It's not purely for that point, Your Honor. It's, as I reiterated previously, it does free the children of his legal control so that only a safe, appropriate, reasonable caregiver is making decisions for the children. And the department feels that is very important.
What decisions is he making from prison that impact, for example, J.O.?
Well, I mean, the future of, he has 3 years left of his majority. It could be decisions regarding therapy, where he goes to school, religious decisions, cultural decisions. As a parent and a joint legal custodian, he would still have a say in those decisions. And given the mother's position and ongoing relationship with him, she definitely would involve him in those decisions. And at this time, Your Honor, I would also, I know I pointed it out in my brief, but I would like to also focus on the scope of appellate review here. The court was only required to balance the children's interests, the father's interests, and the competing interests of the children. The court very explicitly did that in its order regarding best interests. The court acknowledged...
To that point, I agree that the court did do that, but I have some questions about that. The children have an interest, you know, the sort of the competing interest analysis looks to me to have been some of the things that Judge Larkin was already talking about. The children have an interest in receiving care from an appropriate, safe, and stable caregiver who's able to meet their needs. Seems like they have that regardless of how this case is decided, right?
They have an interest in receiving that kind of care from only that kind of caregiver.
Right. And then as it goes on to say Mr. Oluwadu is not safe or appropriate. Actually, he seems like he's perfectly safe right now. He's where he belongs. He's in prison.
Well, there's a difference between physical safety and emotional safety. And there was testimony in the record and findings in the order that this allowing him to maintain his parental rights, especially to EO, would be emotionally traumatic to her and send her the message that she did something wrong and he is entitled to retain his parental rights. So there is a difference and distinction between emotional harm and physical harm that the court did make in its order. Specifically in its palpable and fitness analysis, it states that if he were to maintain his role in the parent-child relationship with the children would be at significant risk of emotional harm at the hands of their father, child one, by continuing to be exposed to her abuser, and child two, by having a parent who has subjected at least one of his own minor child to continued sexual abuse.
The district court could have taken care of that by a finding of CHIPS and an order that he's no longer the legal custodian and he shall have no contact with her during her period of minority. That would have been easy to resolve without a termination.
But, Your Honor, in these circumstances, the statute compels and requires a termination of parental rights petition for both of the children.
But it also requires a consideration of their best interests. And the case law says when they're of an age where their opinion is justified, it shall be considered. I have a problem in this case with the district court after hearing from these two kids regarding what they want and what they think is best, deem their opinion neutral when it's supposed to actually give it great weight.
And I think, Your Honor, that the word neutral could be read to be mitigated or neutralized by the outweighed by the other evidence before the court. And again, you know, witness credibility, the weight to be given to the evidence, this is all in the province of the fact finder that was present at the trial. The trial court had the opportunity to hear the testimony directly from J.O. The judge was present during that. Also heard the testimony from the father where he minimized and denied the abuse that he inflicted on his daughter. The trial court was present for all of that and weighed all of that appropriately. And there is case law that I cited in my brief that the desires of the children did not necessarily equate to their best interests. And while they must be considered, it is only one of many factors to be given to the court's consideration. And there is case law, again, I believe it was the D.C. case, which I cited in my brief, where the child was almost 18, was opposed to the termination, but still the court found that the other factors outweighed that. So it is a balancing analysis, and as long as the court has done that proper balancing analysis, which it has here, it should be upheld. Just because there could be a different interpretation, because appellant disagrees with how the evidence was weighed, that is not an abuse of discretion and not grounds for reversal.
Well, it's not that appellant disagrees, it's that the kids disagree.
Yes, Your Honor, which, again, the court took into account, considered, and weighed against the children's competing interests, which the court ultimately found weighed more than the children's desires, which is in the province of the fact finder that was present during the trial, witnessed the testimony, and weighed all the evidence. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Merchant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use it.
I'd like to pick up on that last point because opposing counsel's position is that weight is the province of the fact finders, what I think she said. And while, of course, that is true as a general proposition, it is not true with regard to a child's preference. The MB case controls this question. It's been long resolved that a child's preference is a singular type, even if you want to call it evidence, it's a singular type of evidence for purposes of termination cases. And the case law is there's not even an open question that a child's preference must be given significant weight. The court gave it neutral weight. And because of that, the balancing test is flawed. Counsel also said there was proper balancing here. It just can't be when the court gave my client's preference only neutral weight.
If we reversed on that basis, what we would have to remand, right?
Well,
if our determination ultimately were you didn't put the scale, you didn't align the scales correctly, that's really a remand outcome.
I don't think it has to be Judge Rodenberg, because ultimately my argument is one of sufficiency of evidence and whether or not the department proved by clear and convincing evidence.
I realize you're making that argument. I'm asking if we reversed on that basis, that is that you didn't weigh the children's preferences and we left it at that, that really calls for remand.
That, if you wanted to remand for the purposes of instructing the trial court to re-weigh based on giving a significant weight, true. But again, my argument is there's insufficient evidence based on a clear and convincing standard of proof of termination being in the child's best interest. All of the three-part balancing test factors weigh in favor of my client having a parental relationship with his father here. He wants the relationship, his father wants the relationship, and all of the competing interests, the safety, the health, the child's preferences, all militate in favor of maintaining the relationship. And again, I'll just say that the court made some erroneous findings in its balancing with respect to safety. We already talked about that. The speculative nature that I go into length in my reply brief, and that includes emotional harm. I don't have it right here in front of me. I'm not going to use my time. But if you look at my reply brief, there was no evidence of emotional harm as it applied to my client. He's in treatment. The therapist never, the department never put on any evidence at all that my client has been impacted in a way that he is suffering emotionally from it. And the notion that he's this is my client we're talking about, a 15-year-old son who wants to have a relationship. For the state to say that that his father's forsaken his rights to be a parent, maybe I shouldn't even go there, but I find that very troubling when the law is very clear that a child in my client's status, his preference, should be given significant weight. And back to the quick question about reasonable efforts, counsel said that the egregious harm was the only matter in this case. It's not true. For purposes, again, of what happens at the very beginning of the case, the petition has two counts. It has the egregious harm under 1B6, and it has 1B4 palpable unfitness. And if you look at the rule, pardon me, but I don't have the new rule at my fingertips, but under the emergency protective rule, it's the old rule 30.09 subdivision 3A, if the department wants to move at that point in time, which the rule allows, to make a finding for purposes of bypass, the department has to give notice if it's right in the rule. There was no notice given here that would allow a party, a parent or a child, to have time, as Judge Slater was asking about or pointing out, to present a case, to prepare and present a case at that point in time. So there has to be notice. The only time that the statutory ground, which triggers a bypass, has to be addressed by the court is at the admit-deny hearing, and that's under the old rule 34.03 subdivision A. It's at that point in time when the court must address a statutory ground. It simply didn't happen in this case. The only two findings that the court made was that a juvenile protection matter, that there was a prima facie case of a juvenile protection matter, and that EO had to be removed from the home for protective care purposes. I see that my time's expired. I would ask the court to reverse the termination order with respect to J.O. Standard of review, look at SC. This court must proceed with great caution in these type of cases, as this court knows well, and can only affirm if the evidence, quote unquote, clearly mandates such a finding. I would submit the evidence on this record does not do that. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We will issue our decision within the expedited time frame, and counsel can be assured, and your clients respectively can be assured, we'll give the case the careful deliberation and attention that it obviously deserves. That's the last matter on the calendar this morning, except for a couple of non-orals, and so we're in recess.